This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Myth of the Maker, a novel of the strange, written by Bruce R. Cordell, narrated by James Carroll Jordan. The Fermi paradox is the apparent contradiction between high estimates of the probability of the existence of extraterrestrial civilization and humanity's lack of contact with or evidence for such civilizations. Hence, Fermi's question, where is everybody? Definition of Fermi paradox, Wikipedia.org. Fermi's question, where is everybody, shows how amazingly stupid humans are. Who are we to imagine we have even the faintest chance of understanding where everybody is? Torakotro. The universe is not only stranger than we imagine, it is stranger than we can imagine. J.B.S. Haldane. Chapter 1. Recursion. Carter Morrison. The disaster that nearly wiped out the planet began in our VR lab on Tuesday morning. Earth survived, if you're reading this. But if someone else gets too clever with math like the six of us did, the same thing could happen all over again. And there's almost nothing anyone can do to stop it. I'm really sorry about that, by the way. Retrofitted computers loomed on tables along one wall of the lab. Screensavers coiled jagged fractal designs across the monitors. Cable bundles held down with duct tape connected the whirring machines to the five lounge chairs we called our VR rigs. I was wearing my favorite purple hoodie with the University of Washington logo stenciled on the front. It wasn't too warm because we kept the lab cool on account of all the computer equipment. Losing that hoodie still makes me sad. Early, for once, Jason Cole walked in with a couple of pizza boxes. Jason's confident posture managed to convey the physicality of someone much older than his actual age of 27. His black hair was thinning a bit at the crown, and his brown eyes looked out over an impressive beard that he was inordinately proud of. The delicious smell of roasted pepperoni and baked cheese had me salivating even before Jason flipped the first box open. A familiar red hut symbol was printed on the grease-stained cardboard lid. "What? No Pagliacci's?" I asked, reaching for a slice. Jason laughed. "They don't deliver. You'll eat this and like it." Jason and I went way back. We met as roommates in our sophomore year of college and got each other through the computer science degrees, then our masters, and even pursued doctorates in the field until we quit academia to found our own indie game studio. 3 years after that, our game company went bust. "At least you remembered the red pepper," I conceded. The white packet tore open, and I scattered hot flakes over my slice, folded it Brooklyn style, and gulped it down. It was warm, but not so hot I burned my mouth. In other words, it was perfect. "So, what do you think? Is today the day?" asked Jason, reaching for more. "Could be. Everyone's got to catch a break sooner or later." Our experiments had been beset with problems, problems that we solved one by one, of course, because that's what you do, unless you decide just not to get out of bed in the morning. "Hey, Carter, leave some for us," called a woman with red hair worn in a long braid down her back. She hurried over, followed by a man in loose chinos and a white polo, perpetually stained with coffee. She was Melissa, Mel as everyone called her, Perkins, and he, Michael Bradley. "Did you get any with pineapple?" Mel asked. Jason guffawed. "Why would I ruin a perfectly good pizza with fruit?" "Variety is the spice of life, Jason," she replied with a hint of exasperation in her voice. "Have you ever tried it?" "As if. What about you, Bradley? You like pineapple?" Bradley only shrugged and chewed. His mind was obviously still on the power issue he'd been asked to solve. Like Jason and me, Mel and Bradley were fellow survivors of my failed game studio. We'd gone down in flames after Ardeen, Land of the Curse, our online role-playing game, failed to move out of beta. My coding skills, which were impressive, if I do say so myself, hadn't been enough to get us the wider attention we needed for a successful crowdfunding campaign. Frankly, the whole episode had been a fucking disaster. Dead in the water. We'd had no funds, no jobs, and no prospects. Made all the worse by the fact we'd done it to ourselves. As a group, Jason, Mel, Bradley, and I left the promise of academic research, however poorly paid, to follow our dreams of making games. Dreams that led nowhere. Ardeen, land of the curse, had turned out to be a curse in truth. Thinking about it still made my stomach hurt. Then a hero rode in. Our old academic advisor, Peter Sanders, got in touch, wondering if we could help him out. He asked us to return to research at the university, even if only for a few months. We're not idiots. We said yes. Sanders put the whole undergraduate team back together using grant money he'd somehow pried from the University of Washington Science Committee. Our job was to figure out how to exploit the astonishing results in Sanders' latest paper, Infinite Processing Through Quantum Recursion. With his breakthrough as our blueprint, we fashioned the superposition chip. We thought we discovered free, unlimited processing power. We were wrong. Jason and I moved aside from the pizza so Mel and Bradley could graze from the open boxes. "How's the power integration coming?" Jason asked Bradley. Bradley's mouth was full of pizza, so he just nodded. Besides electronics, Bradley's claim to fame was prodigious coffee consumption. If anyone drank more coffee in a single day than him, well, they're probably dead. "It's done," Mel answered for Bradley. "We're ready for a simultaneous connection in the enhanced environment." She wiped her hands on a napkin and then went for another piece. Mel had been a graphics modeler in the game studio. She fulfilled the same role here, helping to put together the starting grid and other enhanced environments. "This is going to be radical," Jason said, looking at the VR rigs. "All of us connecting at once." We all knew he was lying, just a little. Jason had a touch of claustrophobia, which he pretended didn't exist. He was both excited and nervous about putting on the goggles again. To hide his trepidation, he usually resorted to impatience. He said, "I can't believe it's taken us 4 months just to get to this point. You sure we've solved the power spike issue?" It was Mel's turn to shrug. She looked at Bradley. Bradley assumed the pained expression of someone wrongfully accused and said, "Hey!" Our last attempt to coordinate a multi-POV session in the starting grid resulted in a couple of burnt-out motherboards. All the extra uninterruptible power supplies under the monitors were Bradley's solution. "I'd be more worried about whether Carter came through on debugging the code," called Alice Lee, who was fiddling with a chipset on an empty table she called her workbench. Alice's brown skin was shiny with sweat, and she wore her black hair pulled back under a kerchief decorated with pink unicorns. Alice hadn't been part of the game studio, but I didn't hold that against her. She'd been working with Sanders as a graduate student before his grant money materialized, and he expanded the team with the rest of us. "Don't worry," I told Alice and everyone with exaggerated bravado. "I've got you covered. The number of hours I'd spent tweaking the code, utilizing the superposition chip, had been exhausting, but everyone knew it. I didn't have to toot my own horn. Too much." "Right," said Alice, but she smiled. He was probably a better coder than I was, but Sanders had her working on the hardware and me on software, because she was definitely better at circuit design than anyone on this continent. "No pizza for you?" Jason asked Alice. Alice shook her head and went back to fiddling. Neither she nor Sanders liked pizza. That didn't stop Jason from buying it whenever it was his turn to get food for the group. Jason was a lot of things, many of them good, but sometimes he came off as a bit of a jerk, especially when it came to pizza. He couldn't understand how anyone could say no to pepperoni. Peter Sanders, the sixth member of the team and our fearless leader, appeared in the doorway, briefcase in hand and white hair, managing to look messy despite its shortness. When he saw the pizza boxes, the corners of his mouth turned down a tiny bit. Most people wouldn't notice, but I've known Sanders for many years. "Jason," he muttered, "next time you draw lunch duty, just tell me, and I'll get food for everyone." "Suits me," he said, without the least trace of shame. "You can be the hero next time and get sushi." Yeah, sometimes Jason could really work your last nerve. On the other hand, he'd been the one who'd helped me put together the game studio, then stood by longest when everything went south. He was loyal, just not especially empathetic. Sanders set his briefcase aside and loosened his tie. "I got your message," he said to Mel. "Are we still a go?" Mel gave him the thumbs up. "We're ready to rock and roll, Peter." He nodded, and then looked at the floor without meeting anyone's eyes directly. We didn't take it personally. Only someone as brilliant as Saunders could have written his quantum recursion paper. I mean, I'm pretty smart, don't get me wrong, everyone says so, but next to Sanders, I'm like a drooling child. Already, single POV immersions in the starting grid were startling in their clarity and response time. To create an artificial experience for five people at once would require 100 times the processing power. The superposition chip promised to give us that. All because of him. When the pizza was gone and everyone who had to go returned from the toilet, we took our places in the VR rig. It took a few minutes to buckle in and put on the equipment. Bradley started music playing over the lav speakers, which had become something of a tradition when we tested. This time, the Beatles serenaded us about strawberry fields and how nothing was real. "Ready?" said Sanders, when the buckling and muttering subsided. His voice was muffled. Everyone but Bradley was strapped in. I glanced around as far as I could in the rig's embrace. The belt around my waist pulled a little too tight, so I loosened it with my gloved hand. The rig included a seatbelt added for safety and a footplate for haptic transfer. Jason, Sanders, and Alice had their goggles down. Mel and I were the only remaining holdouts. I gave her a wink. "Wouldn't you like a nice game of chess?" I asked, modulating my voice to sound artificial like a computer's. Mel laughed. "You're such a nerd. That's why you love me, Mel. You wish." "What?" said Jason, his voice smothered by his rig. "Are you two-timing me, Carter? You told me that I was the one you dreamed about at night." The forced lightness in his voice was hardly noticeable. He was dealing with his issue with enclosed spaces pretty well this time. "You're both delusional," Mel said. "No one loves Carter more than Carter. Everyone knows that." We all laughed, because it was probably true. Except for the time when imposter syndrome intruded and made me wonder what the hell I was doing. "Hey," interrupted Bradley from behind the monitors, "give it a break. Time for hardware check." "Mr. Bradley is correct," said Sanders. "I've got a seminar in 3 hours. Alice said, her voice similarly muted, "You guys can clown around in the VR, unless we crash the starting grid again." "Sorry, Alice," I said. "I know you can't wait to see how deep the rabbit hole goes." Her goggles prevented me from seeing her eyes roll at the old joke, but Mel laughed, which was almost as good. Bradley appeared in my field of view and pantomimed lowering goggles. "Come on, Carter, stop delaying. If this doesn't work, it's not the end of the world. We'll try something else." He knew me too well. If this didn't work, we'd have little to show the science committee when it came time to ask for a grant renewal to continue developing the superposition chip. My ego couldn't take another failure. Pulling the box-shaped device down over my eyes wasn't easy because I was already wearing the haptic gloves. The hardware was partly scavenged from early adopter VR sets that had recently hit the market, and partly of Alice's design. We weren't testing gloves and goggles today, though. We wanted to see how the recursive VR chip handled more than a single point of view simultaneously. What seemed unbelievably realistic to just one person might prove a grainy, jerky, nausea-inducing, obviously artificial environment when 2, 3, or as we decided to test today, 5 sightseers entered the same virtual starting grid. The goggles showed an expanse of blank LED gray, bright, but not enough to blind me. When the simulation went live, the goggles would display the same scene to each of my eyes, slightly offset to give the illusion of depth. The superposition chip's ability to find extra processing power never failed to impress. What would have otherwise been a pixelated tutorial region swiped from a popular resource mining game would instead be rendered with lifelike clarity. Trees, grass, water, and the sky above would look real. Even the blocky crafting table would be sleek and elegant because I'd tweaked the code to turn the blank slab into a terminal resembling the navigation console from the second Star Trek movie. It granted control over the simulation from inside the starting grid. "Begin check," Sanders said. We verbally ran through several tests to make sure all the equipment was working. Haptic gloves and boots, the hydraulic lifts in the chairs, the audio, and the all-important goggles. After dealing with a tiny glitch with Mel's headphones, Bradley announced it was time. "Ready," I said, amidst a hail of assents from the others. Boiling fog flooded my field of view. It unaccountably smelled like the sea. "What the hell?" I muttered. "Damn it! My goggles were borked. I should have been seeing the starting grid. The VR environment we'd programmed. Not all this static." Through the mist, indistinct forms lumbered. I stepped forward and fell into an abyss with sides as sheer as scissor blades. A phantom weight jerked me down. An equation cut a labyrinthine pattern across my skin, drawing blood. Before I could recognize it or cry out, it transformed, becoming an infinite series spiraling away from me like a burned-out galaxy. Beneath the spirals, the bottom of the abyss resolved as the surface of a frozen ocean instance before I smashed through its crystalline face. Ice water embraced me, swallowing my screams in a zero-degree sea, holding me in a cocoon of cold, and stepped into the starting grid, right next to the terminal. Peter Sanders appeared, then Jason, Mel, and finally Alice. Alice scrubbed at her eyes. Sanders toppled, hit his head on the edge of the terminal as he went down, and began to twitch. Jason yelled, "Bradley, shut the fucking simulation down! Something's wrong!" Mel only pointed. Mind still frozen, I looked in the direction she indicated, past the faux brick wall that enclosed the starting grid. Beyond, it was chaos. Did I scream? Cry? I don't know for sure. The endless, shuddering expanse was deeper than any real sky, and it absorbed my gaze. Within its infinite, wheeling eternity, a hunger stirred. My heart raced, and my breath was coming in short gasps. Everything I knew was wrong. Voice trembling, Jason said, I can't get my goggles off." "What?" I ripped my gaze from the strangeness and saw Jason patting at his face. "I can't even feel my goggles. The immersion was never this good, even after we upgraded the haptics." Our VR rigs were designed to make users forget they were actually sitting in a lab, but Jason was right. Normally, the sensation of the goggles, snugged to my face, was ever-present. Pushing them off my head to see the lab, even with my hands swaddled in force-feedback gloves, should have been as simple as thinking about it. But I couldn't. It was as if I wasn't in the lab at all anymore. The fear that kindled when I glanced beyond the starting grid's borders threatened to make my heart burst. So I clamped down on it. Running in circles wouldn't solve a software malfunction or whatever this was. Only logic could fence out panic. Aloud, I said, "How about you, Mel? Can you take off your goggles or your gloves?" Mel's eyes were big as she shook her head. Sanders didn't respond at all, but at least he'd stopped twitching. Of course, he wasn't really hurt because we're just in a simulation. Alice was already at the terminal, hands flickering over one of the keyboards. She glanced up and ordered, "Take a look at this." "Bradley," I shouted at the empty air. "End the simulation. Emergency. Damn it. I mean, this isn't funny. We're having real issues in here." Bradley had apparently stepped out of the lab, leaving us strapped into our VR rigs untended. That was fucking irresponsible of him. When I joined Alice at the console, only gibberish danced across the screens. I keyed for a status update. Reams of data rolled past. I let it auto-scroll, hoping I'd see something, anything, to anchor me. Just more gibberish. Except it wasn't. My gift for pattern recognition engaged. Pressing a key, I slowed the data dump to manual scrolling. I saw the hint of an underlying order. I typed more commands to the system. My queries brought up new rafts of data. It all pointed at something that was, simply put, unbelievable. "Are you seeing this?" I said to Alice. "Yeah, some kind of hardware crash. I can't seem to stop it cycling. None of this makes any sense." "It does, if you, shift your paradigm. See right here? The superposition of our qubit processing chip became entangled with an entirely new regime." I spoke calmly instead of shouting or screeching. A detached part of me was proud of my self-control. "That's what it's supposed to do," she said uncertainly. "Not to this degree. We've been squeezing a lot of extra cycles out of your hardware, sure, but this is beyond anything we could have ever imagined. It's like we've tapped into a pre-existing network, one that seems limitless." "I don't think our starting grid is being hosted on our lab server anymore. We're someplace else." "That's impossible," Alice said. "Stop being a jerk." "Look," I said, and typed a new command, my hands shaking. "We still have a link to the original server, but it's outside this environment. The starting grid was downloaded from there and..."
"And what?"
A splinter of an idea pulled me from my daze. I said, "We can use this console to arbitrarily change the rules inside this virtual reality environment."
"Well, sure, we can spawn more trees, torches, or crawlers to our heart's content. We can change the color of the sky. That's how we program the terminal. But what good does that do us when we can't get our goggles off?"
"It means we're not trapped here," I said.
"Huh?" she said.
Then, "Oh, because you're saying we'd be trapped in the simulation otherwise."
"Shut up. I don't think you're funny. I'm not trying to be."
Alice hunched her shoulders and scowled at me. "Unless you're having better luck getting out of your rig,
you're wrong. There's no way we can be trapped in a VR. It makes no goddamn sense."
"Okay." She wasn't wrong. It didn't make any goddamn sense. That didn't change the fact that I couldn't figure out how to get out of the simulation.
"But you are right about one thing," Alice muttered, transfixing me with a glare as if this was all my fault.
"Which is?"
"We need to fix this."
I nodded. Alice and I bent to the console. Elite athletes talk about being in the zone, that magical place where mind and body work in perfect sync and movements seem to flow without conscious effort. Coders experience the same thing. When time becomes meaningless as fingers deliberately strike the keys, problems slowly resolve and solutions eventually emerge. I fell into that flow as I delved into the strange substrate beyond the starting grid. My fingers hit the keys with more authority, harder and sharper.
"Carter, you were right about something," said Alice at one point. "The system hosting this simulation is impossibly large."
"Yeah," I mumbled. We were looking at the same data. Words failed. Nothing was big enough to contain the network. Nothing, unless it lay in the quantum foam that lapped past the edges of the universe itself. Maybe the dark energy that underpinned reality was the shadow cast by this network, or maybe dark energy was the network, living in the wavelets of virtual particles and curled magnetic fields. Compared to the wind-tossed white caps of our visible universe, dark energy constituted the unending depths beneath, vast and alien. And we'd plunged in like fools. What if the quantum states of our minds had transferred, interpolated by a system whose resources dwarfed galaxies? It was sort of like being trapped in our own avatars. Something caught my attention. Among all the other wonders hinted at, the data streaming from the console suggested that if we requested it, the dark energy network would print a version of us at some arbitrarily defined location. Print, as in recreate a full three-dimensional version of a living person without the need for a physical printer to do so other than the network itself. "What do you make of this?" I asked Alice. "What?" Not wanting to prejudice her, I just pointed out the relevant sections. She squinted, scratched her head, and frowned. It was amazing, the fidelity of the experience. This didn't seem like VR. It seemed real. A simulation so true to life that it might as well have been reality. "This code seems to suggest the network is designed for travelers," Alice said, interrupting my thoughts. "Travelers who upload scans, then print out new instances of themselves elsewhere, in the universe?" That's what I was thinking. But everything scrambled. Like there was some sort of major crash, and the system only came back part of the way. Shivers of awe ran down my spine. This was cosmic. This dark energy network we'd stumbled into. Was it designed to create doorways by printing travelers at the destination they desired in the world, or normal matter? If so, by whom? Where had they gone? And what had happened to create such chaos in the system? Maybe the answers to those questions were linked. Someone, Jason, I realized, grabbed my shoulders and spun me away from the console. "Hey," I said. "I was right in the middle of..." A storm had rolled in while Alice and I had been lost in the data. Clouds piled higher than worlds, threatened to tumble across the borders of the starting grid. Green lightning danced in their depths. Pretty. Eerie, too. But I bent back to the console. Data scrolling on a side screen revealed new, ancillary code. Something that we hadn't written and something that hadn't been present before now. It was so complex that I couldn't begin to scroll through it all. And it was active. New threads lit up the screen by the hundreds. Something was actively trying to crash the program describing our virtual space and override it with billions more lines. When I tried to analyze it, all I got was noise. Encrypted, of course. Unlike our starting grid. "Alice, do you see this?" I pointed at the screen. She glanced over and frowned. "What the?" "It's the storm," I said. I glanced up again at the boiling clouds. "It's trying to force its way into the starting grid." "Like it's alive," she said. "Oh, fuck. The grid hadn't been built with security in mind." Great green spheres tumbled within the gathering cloud, jerking and whirling as if caught in the frenetic grip of madmen on speed. Some of the spheres splintered, revealing blobs of quivering yellow-black sludge, like melted wax, or another part of my mind screamed, like putrefying flesh. The sludge ran together and massed towards the starting grid, as if attempting to form some hideous monstrosity, probing at the edges of our sanctuary. Before each new terrible form could congeal, it fell back before beginning anew to grow into something even more appalling, like sentient waves of chaos lapping at the foundations of reality. Emerald lightning stabbed from the nearest thunderhead, leaping across the threshold, breaking my fascination with the green globes and what they disgorged. The bolt transfixed Sanders, straight through his forehead, like a fishing line of laser light. The tendril pulled the man upright. Sanders' eyes and mouth snapped open. His irises flamed the same green as the lightning falling all around us. "Motherfucker," I shouted. Sanders convulsed, bent over, and heaved. Nothing came up. He wiped his mouth, then looked up at all of us. His eyes were still green. He opened his mouth as if to speak, but all that came out was strange noises, like he'd forgotten how to talk or even use his tongue. When he staggered and almost fell, Mel grabbed him.
"Peter, what happened? Are you all right?"
I wanted to tell Mel to get away from him because he was obviously not all right, but I couldn't make my mouth form the words. Sanders began to shake like a leaf in Mel's grip, then just as suddenly stopped. His emerald eyes fastened onto her, and he tried to speak again. His voice was the sound of fabric tearing. He said,
"Let us in."
"What?"
Mel said.
"Maybe don't touch him," Jason said, his voice tight. I nodded agreement. Mel released Sanders. The man swayed like a marine plant but didn't go over. In a strangely boneless gesture, he pointed up at the clouds. Behind them, the hint of vast creatures swam. My eyes threatened to cross because what they saw were things like starfish crossed with industrial equipment. If starfish were the size of entire city neighborhoods...
"Holy shit," I yelled. That clenched it. Those cloud things were after us, and they were actively trying to enter the starting grid, and...
"Carter," said Alice, her voice oddly composed, given that Sanders seemed to be possessed and creatures straight out of Lovecraft swelled in ever greater density at the edge of our Earth-like domain. Her firmness helped me control my rising panic. I glanced at the screen she indicated. More data, splayed, hinting at new secrets of existence. But I was too rattled to make any sense of it. What am I looking at? "This represents our connection back to the lab," she explained. "However we got injected into this network, a connection remains. We could use it to get back if we had time to decode what's going on, but look!" Her finger jabbed. "Our connections are compromised. They're corrupted. Whatever those things out there are, they've already tapped into us. Sanders is worse, but we're all affected. I think they're going to use us, our bodies, back in the lab, to route traffic back to our origin. Out of this network and back to Earth." Sanders groaned again, blinked, and repeated himself, maybe in warning.
"Let us in."
Insanity. It was unbelievable. All of it was like a bad dream that I desperately wanted to wake up from and laugh about. And yet there we were.
"You need to get your shit together, Carter. You need a plan." The analytical part of my brain clamped down on the panic. The part that wanted me to look, stare out at the cloud-swaddled green spheres, and completely lose my shit. Alice's explanation got me part of the way to understanding. But an intuition, whose source I'm still not certain about, got me the rest of the way there. I somehow knew Alice was right. It was obvious. Sanders, Mel, Alice, Jason, and I would serve as a physical point of connection out of the dark energy network into the world of normal matter. We'd be a beachhead for vast creatures that had been swimming in this dark energy network for who knows how many millions or billions of years. "They've done this before," Sanders muttered, sounding more like himself, thank God. "They've done it millions of times, billions. They never stop. They reach out forever, consuming."
"Done what?" yelled Jason, his voice a strangled entreaty. "I've never seen him more scared."
Sanders coughed, staggered, blinked some more. Finally he managed to speak.
"Eaten any world that connected to their network. They're like carnivores that eat planets."
The term came to me. They're planetivores, I named them. Then I caught Sanders' horrific implication. This is why we found no evidence of intelligent life elsewhere in the universe. They were all eaten when they discovered this fucking network. Sanders nodded, green liquid dribbling from the corner of his mouth. He said, I can feel them in my mind. They're excited, hungry, unstoppable. And here we were, responsible for opening the door to Earth for them. It was the end of the fucking world, and we were to blame. Unless I did something unthinkable. Jason jostled me as he made room for himself at the console. His wild eyes scanned the screens. He said, Carter, get us out of here. If you can't, we're all going to end up like Sanders. I'm trying, I panted, pointing at the data. But it's not that simple, see? Earth and this new network are connected. They weren't before. We're the link. Us. If we don't sever the connection... Jason's hands went to the controls. He started typing, and I saw immediately what he was doing. He's always been a quick study. He was going to pull all of us straight back out of the system despite the corruption. Jason, stop! I grabbed his shoulder. We're compromised, all of us, not just Sanders. See, I yelled, gesturing to include everyone. We can't just disengage. We have to... Jason shrugged out of my grasp, muttering, That's not going to happen to me. It has already. He ignored me. Of course he did. I knew what he was like. He wasn't going to listen, and if Jason finished his desperate attempt to jack all of us out, the planetivores would come along, using the printing technology to manifest themselves in reality. They'd overwrite their new environment. To them, regular matter, including our minds and bodies, were probably just another operating system to be cracked and exploited. Stopping that from happening was the only thing that mattered. I put my hand on Jason's sternum, then shoved him away from the console as hard as I could. Unprepared, he fell and rolled, yelling, What the hell? It's got to be me, I said as I called up new menus on the console. Saving yourself, is that it, you selfish prick, Carter? Jason went for me again. But Alice and Mel got in the way, even though they weren't quite sure what I was doing. Sanders did, but he was too far gone. But maybe I could save him, Earth and all of us, from a similar fate. Or at least save Earth. The next moments were vague. Maybe the same corruption that was in Sanders whispered knowledge into my mind, or maybe I'm just that good. Either way, I was able to commandeer the virtual particle printing array inherent in the network, its raison d'etre. If we recalled our consciousnesses, as Jason had just tried, we'd cement the creature's connection to Earth. They might even be already back there, using our bodies for themselves like demons possess people in religious stories. So I had to get out a different way, by using the printing function embedded in the dark energy network to print a new instance of myself without using the compromised link to my old body. In effect, there'd be two of me at once. There wasn't time to get everything exactly right. Clothing, for instance, wasn't going to make the trip back. So I queued up commands to print myself as close as I could to where my original body was strapped into a VR rig dreaming, but somewhere I could appear without drawing undue attention. The command executed, and I was funneled up the link, out of the network and back into the university campus, a freshly printed dark energy traveler, leaving everyone else behind. Chapter 2 Disconnection. Carter Morrison. Falling in the men's shower knocked the wind out of me. Of course, 5 seconds ago, my lungs hadn't existed, at least not here. When I printed back onto the university campus, I'd somehow managed to appear 2 feet higher than the floor, then fallen straight down on my back. Idiot. My chest heaved,
and my heart thundered. Sucking molasses through a straw would have been easier. The floor was cold and gritty on my skin. My fingers curled spasmodically, ineffectually. Is this what panic felt like? A scrap of breath hissed between my teeth, then another. Finally, the fist in my chest unclenched, and I gulped in lungful after lungful of air. I was going to live a while longer, a chance to get older, but probably not any wiser. You all right? I realized I was lying naked on the floor of the showers in the University Athletic Center. The guy inquiring about my health was two stalls down, his hand poised in mid-shampoo. Trying to speak, I coughed instead. I settled for nodding. You sure? He said. Looks like you were having some kind of fit. Slipped and fell, I finally forced out. Knocked the wind out of me, is all. I patted my chest. Okay, good, he said, obviously relieved he wouldn't have to administer CPR to a nude stranger. Staggering out of the showers, I snagged a towel from a stack near the door and dried off, which gave me a chance to look around for something to wear. I'd never stolen clothing before, but as I'd hoped, a locker room was a great place for that kind of petty larceny. No one noticed as I pilfered an unattended locker, so I avoided difficult questions. In borrowed blue jeans, a gray T-shirt, and Converse sneakers, I exited the athletic center. Hopefully they didn't belong to the helpful guy from the shower. The shoes pinched and the pants were too loose, but it was lucky they fit as well as they did. My plan, such as it was, didn't immediately fizzle for lack of a belt. Running past the biology building onto Colorado Street, I headed towards the engineering building, which housed the VR lab. To be safe, I tried to print back at a distance from the VR lab, so Bradley wouldn't see a duplicate me appear out of nowhere and freak out. Was that what I was? A duplicate? I felt like me, not like a copy. Probably better to worry about my philosophy of existence later, if there was a later, I told myself. Finally, bursting into the engineering lab, chest heaving and mind spinning, I raced for the VR lab. A man in a coffee-stained white polo stood outside the lab entrance, a mug in one hand and a red metal toolbox dangling from the other. Michael Bradley. Bradley squinted at me. I rubbed one temple, wondering how to explain myself. Bradley had been monitoring us when we went into the VR simulation, which, according to the wall clock, was less than 30 minutes ago. It seemed much longer. Carter, Bradley said, what are you doing out here? Hey, I replied, call of nature. Mm-hmm, he grunted, nodding slightly. You had too much coffee, he sipped from his own mug. I nodded, as if agreeing. What about you, I asked. Why aren't you in the lab? I printed back at a location outside the VR chamber because I hadn't wanted anyone to witness my arrival. If I'd known Bradley wasn't monitoring us, I could have saved myself a lot of time. Server sent up a couple of faults, Bradley said. I had to replace some fuses, if you can believe it. He rattled his toolbox. Electrical fluctuations, I guess, but the extra power supplies smoothed everything out. The test environment couldn't handle all variables, I said, remembering the shuddering expanse that opened beyond our virtual starting grid. Strange beyond all reckoning. We thought we'd reached into some sort of perfect mathematical abstraction, promising as many cycles as we'd ever need for truly lifelike VR. Instead, we'd pinged a network so primeval that it predated the solar system. A network crawling with hungry things, eager to reach the orbits and atoms of our natural universe. Bradley snorted. Variables. Shouldn't make any difference. Probably the idiots over in aerospace are using some unapproved CAD extension. I shrugged, as if unconcerned. Sure. I wiped sweat from my upper lip. You better finish with those fuses. I'll hook myself back in. Please, I thought, turn around and head back to the server room. Don't make me. Nah, I'm done. Shit. Oh, good, I said, my voice faint. Shit. How was I going to deal with Bradley? How really was I going to deal with everyone? I hadn't given the next part of my plan much thought. It was too horrible, going far beyond what I'd already done. Yet there I was. I opened the door and gestured for Bradley to precede me. He walked through and set the toolbox on the shelf inside the entrance. I followed him in, and, without thinking about what I might use it for, quietly lifted the toolbox. It was cold and heavy in my hands. Bradley didn't notice. The Beatles lilted from the room speakers, singing about a girl who came to stay. No one plugged into the VR could hear it, thanks to sound-canceling headphones. The five lounge chairs, each sprouting a garden of wires, LED status lights, oversized gloves, and blocky goggles, were exactly as I'd left them. One seat held Jason. I let my gaze slide off him. The other four seats held Sanders, Mel, Alice, and me. Bradley hummed along to the song as he checked his monitors. Then he froze. Carter, what the fuck? He was staring at my original, still snugged into the rig. I swung, bringing the toolbox crashing down on Bradley's head. He crumpled without a word. Shit, I whispered, then swallowed. Tried not to think about what I had to do next, about whether I'd just heard the sound of crunching bone. Stepping past Bradley's lolling form, I approached Jason. He looked relaxed, as if asleep. Jason and I had been inseparable for years. The memory of the hundreds of times we'd made midnight runs for fast food after late coding sessions overwhelmed me. More times than not, I was short of cash. Jason always picked up my tab. Maybe I should reconsider. Maybe I was wrong. Maybe... Stop it, I told myself. You have to be sure. You can fall apart later. So I emptied the toolbox on the floor at Jason's feet. He didn't so much as quiver at the metallic racket. I rooted through the pile and finally selected a long screwdriver and a mallet. I had to sever the connection between the flesh in front of me and the things that lived in the dark energy network that had absorbed Jason's soul. Things had gone way too pear-shaped to simply remove his goggles and unplug him from the rig. Quantum entanglement meant that contamination had already occurred. I'd seen it happen. Goggles hit his eyes, and I was glad. A screwdriver stung my hand each time I brought the mallet down on the butt, driving the fucking thing into Jason's head. An unplanned scream ripped my throat raw. The speakers lamented about trying to leave a girl. What was Lennon trying to tell me? Damn it, focus, you're only doing what's logical, I told myself. Jason's body was already compromised, and his mind, perhaps even his soul, if such a thing existed, was elsewhere. He'd made the transition and was still, in some sense, alive down in the substrate. Unless what I'd done to ensure that I was the one standing in the lab with the mallet and screwdriver, not Jason, had sealed everyone's fate. Everyone's but mine. Bending over, I threw up on the carpet. You don't have time for this, I told myself. Stop it. I stumbled to the next rig, concentrating on anything other than what I was doing. Were my friends still safe on the other side, or was I really murdering them? My plan required the former to be true, for the sake of my sanity. Everyone got the same brutal attention, Sanders, Alice, even Mel. I told myself they were all still alive on the starting grid. I wasn't actually killing them. The planetivores would do that. Part of me was sure I was a coward and a liar, and I retched twice more before I got to the fifth and final rig. But only dry heaves. Nothing was left to come up. One more time. Don't think about it. That he's got the exact same L-shaped scar as you from a boating accident 15 years ago, that... The original Carter Morrison twitched in his chair, then fumbled off his goggles. I met my own gaze. Something was wrong with his eyes.
Fractals bloomed there in the green of old phosphor computer monitors. I screamed. He howled wordlessly along with me. My original struggled in his its traps, but remained snared in the buckles. I whacked it with my mallet over and over. What was in my original body wasn't me. It was something from the primeval matrix, something that had sniffed fresh data and was hungry for more. Here on Earth, it had discovered a whole new world of information encoded in molecules and atoms, optical fibers and nerve impulses. The things that lived in the dark energy network were predators of a whole new class. Planetivores. I stopped hitting it with my mallet when its strangled wail ceased and the green in its eyes guttered out. Someone was still screaming. When I covered my mouth, the sound stopped. Carter, I whispered to myself. Now's no time to lose it. I nodded. Right, I replied. You're a smart man, Carter. A couple of giggles escaped me before I clenched my teeth together so hard my molars clicked. A soulful voice over the speakers encouraged me not to carry the world upon my shoulders, that it's a fool who, when I smashed the mallet into the CD player, blissful silence followed. Things remained to be done. Even though blood was stiffening my clothes and making my fingers tacky. Lurching to the computer interface, I narrowly escaped stepping in my own vomit. My hands left red smears on the computer keys as I checked the backup server in the basement that hosted all our work. Calling up a command line, I scheduled a complete data wipe at the blinking cursor prompt. The wipe included all the remote backups describing our work. Just as important, I triggered a failsafe in Sanders' experimental chip. In half an hour, all the qubits composing the chip's heart would fall out of superposition, rendering the thing into so much useless silicone. No one else would be able to recreate our experiment. That was important. Assuming my plan worked. Shutting down all the servers would be like pulling up anchor, I hoped. Once the servers were offline, nothing else in that strange network we breached could use the same hack I'd used to print myself back to Earth. Maybe. Actually, what if there was another way to pass between Earth and the dark energy network? One that didn't require a quantum chip like the one we'd used. The unexpected intuition tickled my brain, hinting at a way different than how I'd returned. A way to translate instead of extruding a duplicate physical instance. A way to make the shift without worrying about air for lungs, clothing, specific location. No, that wasn't possible. Leaning like a drunk on the computer terminal, I barely held myself upright as new doubts tried to break my conviction. With no open connection, reaching between the real universe and a network hosted in dark energy wavelets would be extraordinarily difficult. Please let that be true. Otherwise, I'd just killed the bodies of my friends for no reason. Oh, shit, was the Earth still fucked? The planetivores knew about Earth. They'd continue to swarm around the naked grid we'd stupidly created. The grid was like an open wound gushing blood into a shark-infested water. The wound needed to be sealed off, like slapping a cap onto an undersea oil gusher. Was there something else I could do? Maybe. I sucked in a long breath and had an idea. A brilliant, wonderful, half-baked, and undoubtedly insane way to further protect the world from the primordial network. I didn't have something perfectly suited for what I'd imagined, but I did have a fat chunk of functioning code and 25 minutes before the servers were wiped and the chip fried. Why not give it a shot? Typing furiously at the main computer, I opened a link to Ardeen, Land of the Curse. Although it never fully launched, a limited beta version of the failed game remained active across a handful of fan sites. The beta code was unwieldy, bloated, and more than a bit buggy, but maybe, it would impose rules to a sector of the strange substrate. A substrate completely unformatted before we created our starting grid and created a direct connection between Earth and the network. Ardeen would smother and block that connection, if imposed on the network, or at least encrypted. Please let that be true. I began transferring the code from the game directly into the server hosting the superposition chip. There wasn't time to disconnect the 2,000 or so playtesters currently connected to Ardeen. They probably wouldn't notice anything as the code base around them replicated down in the stratum. Stratum had a sort of ring to it. Maybe that's what I should call the network. No, too geological. The network was far more strange. Only a minute remained on the wipe clock when the copy completed. It was either working or it wasn't. The only way I could know was go look, which would be dangerously insane. But what about my friend's entangled mind still down there? My mind was safely extricated. If I went back in, I'd risk losing myself all over again. But maybe I could save their souls. What would that mean for me? Looking at the corpse that shared my face, limp and slick with blood, made the decision easier. Here, I was already dead. With shaking hands, I stripped the VR equipment from Carter, from me, and loosened the straps holding the flaccid body upright. I shoved it out and took its place. The gloves and goggles were still warm. Static boiled against my eyes and ears. It scratched my skin and tasted like metal. I logged in. My consciousness was swept down the connection, plunging into unfolding fractal architectures. My eyes, reflexively, closed against the overwhelming complexity. Then I stepped through to another place and pulled the door shut behind me. When I opened my eyes again, everything was different. Chapter 3 Investigation. Catherine Manners. 3 years later. The port scanner failed to turn up a single open connection. The email spoofing attack hadn't fooled anyone. And the packet sniffer was a complete bust because there just wasn't any data. Kate's usual techniques, plus a few of Raoul's paranoid schemes, had been for nothing. BDR's servers were locked down, so Kate resorted to social engineering. It was a cliché, but only because it worked. Success just required a bit of play-acting. Picking up the phone and pretending to be an angry supervisor threatening the job of a confused customer service rep had gotten her results before. Not this time. Bank's digital reality wasn't large enough that she could pull off impersonating a nameless authority in HR. And as far as she could tell, there wasn't a remote connection available for off-site administration, which made no fucking sense. What if the servers needed to be rebooted in the middle of the night? What if one of Seattle's notorious snow days turned the roads into parking lots and no one could get in? Kate escalated. She donned a uniform, rented a cart, and decorated it with a red watering can and a handful of houseplants. She pushed the cart into BDR's lobby minutes before closing. She flashed her lanyard, "Plant Care Service," it proclaimed in friendly green letters, to the security guy. A departing employee was kind enough to hold the elevator for her, which normally required a key card. Most people are instinctually helpful, even if it meant breaking security procedures. She smiled and thanked the nice man as the steel doors of the elevator closed. She exited on the third floor and started rounds, confident, as if she'd visited a dozen times before. Anyone watching the video feed saw her watering the plants. The servers she was looking for were on this floor, somewhere. moving from planter to planter through the dimmed office, built up the layout in her mind. She found the server room after about 5 minutes. Even if the entrance hadn't been labeled, the sound of the fans would have given it away. White